Paramananda is going to be talking on poetry, soul making, and meditation. Paramananda.
Okay. Okay, hello.
Hello.
Do you want a chair?
No, I'm going to stand up, I think. I'd be kind of more energetic. Okay, the first thing to say, quite unusually for me, I've written this talk. Unfortunately, I can't read it because of my eyesight, so the fact that I've written it is kind of largely irrelevant. What are you going to get? It's probably not much I've written. But I am going to see if I can get the text put on the Centre's website. So that will probably be a bit more of a coherent and structured version of what you're going to get now, which is probably going to be a bit more of a random version. And the other provisos, there's a few poems in it, but obviously when you're doing poetry from memory, it's probably not going to be word perfect. Yeah. So just those two provisos. Okay, so I've called this talk Poetry, Soul Making, and Meditation. And I'm kind of assuming, I think it's probably fair enough to assume, most of you have some kind of sense of poetry. And as we're at a Buddhist center, probably some sort of sense of what meditation is. So I'm going to start off just by saying a little bit about this idea of soul. In this, I'm largely taking my cue from James Hillman, the archetypal psychologist James Hillman, but also from, you know, probably over the last 15 years or so, sort of working with this idea of soul in my own meditation, and also in teaching meditation. So, and why I want to talk about it, and why I want to talk about this in poetry, is I feel that both of these things, poetry and this Hillman-esque idea of soul, has personally been very useful for me, very enriching for me. So that's why I chose to talk about this. Okay. So the first thing to say about soul, or Hillman's use of soul, and my use of soul following Hillman, is that it hasn't really got very much to do with the Christian idea of soul. Okay, so try and put that aside. So whatever presuppositions or ideas you have about what soul might mean, see if you can just put them to one side. So Hillman adopted this term soul really as an alternative to the word psyche. Okay, even though psyche as a term has very deep mythical roots within the Greek, he felt that psyche had become, had been sort of taken over by psychology in particular, and by a kind of medical model, and even more recently, perhaps, by a sort of scientific idea. And he feels, and I think quite rightly, that this doesn't do justice to the richness of psyche. It makes psyche into a pathology. It makes it into something that needs to be cured or treated or analysed or understood in a very particular way, which Hillman feels kind of takes the richness out of the term. Yeah. So he's using it as a sort of alternative, you could say a poetic expression of what we might understand as psyche. I don't know what you understand by that word. That in itself is quite a difficult word as well, but anyway. So he's using soul as a replacement. Hillman himself comes from a Jungian background. He was trained as a Jungian analyst. He hasn't worked as an analyst for very many years. He's basically a sort of essayist and a commentator, you could say, a writer for these days. And so he comes from a background of Jung, but I think it's fair to say he differs from Jung in that I think he would say that he feels that Jung overemphasized this process of individualization is somehow made, by doing that, kind of made the soul teleological, yeah? Gave it a sort of purpose. I think he would also say that in general, psychology or most strands of therapy, the psyche has become more or less exclusively seen as something that's interior, so inside the head. And Hillman would very strongly object to this reading of what he's calling soul. He would say that soul is a property of, it's not a thing in itself, it's a quality of things. And not only is it a quality of human beings, it also can be a quality of objects in the world, animate or inanimate. So it can be a quality of a building, it can be a quality of nature, that's found in nature, and it's also a quality of the world itself in terms of what you call world soul. So you can speak about the world itself having some sort of soul. So very broadly speaking, it's a very broadly speaking, we can sort of identify soul with the feminine. Yeah. And this is in contrast, and really we can only start to understand soul in contrast to its sort of polarity, which Hillman calls spirit. Again, quite a particular and idiosyncratic use of the word spirit. Yeah. So Hillman has these two sort of polarities. He has soul on the one hand, which he identifies with the feminine, and he has spirit on the other, which he identifies with the masculine. But in saying this, it's very important not to fall into the trap of thinking this has got anything to do with gender. It's not gendered in this sense. We might very broadly say that women tend a little bit more towards soul, and men tend a little bit more towards spirit, perhaps. But I don't think that's very useful. It's not a very useful way of looking at it, I don't think. What I think is a bit more useful is that we could say soul tends towards body. So in a sense, soul is about the guts of us. Yeah? It's about the internal kind of process. And we could perhaps say that spirit has more of an affinity with mind. Spirit kind of likes the idea of pure mind. Yeah, and I might say a bit more about this later, we'll see how it goes. Yeah. So anyway, I hope that I'd be saying more about this sort of soul. So it's a sort of initial, just try and get us find the language a little bit, yeah. So coincidentally, 2 weeks ago, I was listening to the radio. I was listening to, I want to say Johnny Marr, he was the guitarist with Smith, wasn't he? What was the other one?
Andrew.
Start of the week, is that?
Andrew Marr.
Andrew Marr, yeah. Johnny Marr's brother, Andrew. Start of the week. It was quite interesting. They had this guy on there, Ian McGilchrist, I think his name was. He was a psychologist. And he was talking about left brain, right brain. Now, usually I'm very uninterested in this sort of way of talking. Yeah? It doesn't interest me at all. But this Ian McGilchrist, if that was his name, had a far more sort of nuanced reading of this than you usually get. And it was very interesting what he was saying. So he was saying, there's a definite anatomical and neurological split between the two hemispheres. But this doesn't mean that one side of the brain does one thing and the other side of the brain does the other thing. He was saying, in all activities, both sides of the brain are involved. But that involved in quite different ways. And he gave an example, which I found rather touching in a way. He gave an example of a bird, little bird. I thought of it as a little bird. And trying to pick up seeds between pebbles, yeah, presumably quite small pebbles. So it was doing this very delicate and focused activity. So he is saying this would be done by the left side of his bird's brain. This is a more rational, sort of focused side of the brain. And he was saying, but at the same time, this bird, this little bird, has to keep an eye out for predators. You know, has to. So it also needs, at the same time, it needs this lot more open, sort of wider, broader awareness. And he was saying, well, this would be more of a right side of the brain. So I found that quite interesting. And he went on to talk about how increasingly he felt, know how you prove it, or whatever matters, you prove it. He was saying, in modern culture, more and more, I've got to get the sides right, the rational side, which is left, isn't it?
Yeah.
The rational side of the brain is becoming more and more dominant in our culture. And he was saying, the interesting thing about the rational side of the brain is that it doesn't know what it doesn't know. It doesn't have a sense of what isn't in its own purview, you know. It doesn't have a sense of what's outside of its particular perspective. And this is quite unlike the other side, this broader side, which kind of knows as another way of looking at things. So he was saying there's a real danger in this, because as we become more and more this side, is that the right side? Of our brain, as we become more and more
left-sided,
we think we exclude more and more. We think that's all there is in the world. Yeah? Our concerns, or our focused concerns, become more and more excluding of anything else. So our view of the world and our view of the way we behave in the world and we're in the world becomes narrower and narrower, becomes more restricted. And I won't go into what are some of the consequences of this, but you can see this very much as a sort of the consequence of this to some extent. You can see very much as sort of consumer capitalism. You know, we're basically concerned with our own stuff on the whole. Anyway, why this struck me, one of the reasons it struck me because it was very similar to what Hillman says about spirit and soul. So Hillman says about spirit and soul is that spirit, which you could identify more with the rational side, is not really interested in anything outside of itself. So when we're completely in the thrall of what Hillman would call spirit, we're very direct. We're very clear. We know just where we want to go, but we're not really interested in anything else. In this sense, it's you can see it as reflective or related to the sort of heroic. It's related to the sort of heroic ego. So if you think about someone like Achilles in Homer, he's very kind of directed. He's not really interested. He's not really connected the world. So this is a consequence where you just get kind of spirit. On the other hand, soul is a lot more open. Soul can bear spirit. It's not, you know, it can bear spirit, where spirit finds it very hard to bear soul. And we'll see why this is relevant a bit later, maybe. Hopefully. Who knows? It might just sort of hang there, but, which is fine. Which is fine. So, you're going to have to think of this talk more as soul. So soul is kind of fairly vague and meandering, and kind of circles around things, and it's not really that interested in pinning things down or coming to conclusions. So, I don't know that you're going to get any conclusions out of me. Anyway, so when I was thinking about soul, I mean, this is very interesting to me. I think my main access to soul has been kind of through poetry, partly through meditation, and I'll talk about that a bit later, but probably most strongly through poetry. So to try and give you a bit of an idea, a bit of a feeling. And this is all we're ever going to get of soul. We're not going to pin it down or define it. See, from the point of view of spirit, this is very frustrating. Spirit wants to pin everything down and have it clear. But actually, you can't ever do that with this idea of soul. One of its characteristics is always kind of a bit vague. It's always kind of slightly shifting. It's kind of a bit amorphic. So, but I think one way we could approach it, actually before I do the poem, I mean another, I think it's important to not think of soul as a thing. It's not a thing. It's a quality of thing. And so perhaps if you think about food, we sometimes, interesting enough, we sometimes have this term that is soul food. And I think what's meant by that soul food, although this is taking it rather literally in a way, but perhaps what's meant by soul food is something that is deeply nourishing. It's food that nourishes us. In the Jewish tradition, I think it's probably fair to say soul food is very often associated with chicken soup, isn't it? And chicken soup, if you kind of smell that chicken soup, it's what it is, it's resonant of the mother. Yeah, it's resonant of the family, and it's resonant of the tradition. So it kind of connects us back, and this is an aspect of soul, it's kind of connecting us down into the psyche, into family, which of course are always in the psyche, if you see what I mean. Our psyche is partly populated by family and ancestors and race. And soul is something that connects us down. It's a bit like if you go into a building and have a response. Some buildings are very soulful. You go into certain churches even, or certain places in nature, and they have this sense of kind of connecting you into the past, yeah? Connecting you down into yourself and into the sort of roots of your life, if you like, where you've come from. Anyway, and equally, I think quite a nice example, I think, to music. So it's not necessarily James Brown, I don't think, which is more funk, isn't it? But any music can kind of be soulful. And the example always comes to my mind, because I love both of them very dearly. And interestingly enough, the example I usually give is Ella Fitzgerald and Billie Holiday. That's both two fantastic singers. But you could say Ella Fitzgerald, if you know her, she's basically spirit. She's basically up. Light and open and joyous, and Billie Holiday's kind of down here. So I don't know. She's got. If you hear them sing the same song, I've got recordings of them singing the same song. I didn't know this, but one of the joys of iPod is that sometimes you get them to play a song because it plays the same version. But if you've got more than one version. So I've been hearing them lately singing the same songs, and there's such a different feeling to that song, such a different sense. And of course, you know, great singers, I think, you know, they always have a bit of both, but you could say that Billie Holiday, they definitely got more predominantly soul, and Ella Fitzgerald is predominantly spirit. Interestingly enough for me, this is an aside, not won't be in the text. Interesting enough for me, Ella Fitzgerald's very soulful because my father was completely obsessed with Ella Fitzgerald. So it takes me right back. So soul, of course, you kind of say can't be pinned down. So for me, actually, listening to Ella Fitzgerald's a very soulful experience. But generally speaking, I think we can make that distinction. Anyway, here's our first poem. And this is one of my favourite poems, a couple of my favourite poems. I thought I'd sort of indulge myself tonight. This is one of my favourite poems, and it's a Shane Heaney poem. And Seamus Heaney, he's a very soulful sort of poet, I think you could say. And we'll have a poem, and then I'll say a little. So this is the guttural muse. summer, and at midnight, I smelt the heat of the day at the window, over the hotel car park. I breathed the muddied night air of the lake as I watched the young crowd leave the discotheque. Their voices rose up thick and comforting as oily bubbles of feeding tench sent up. That day at dusk, the slimy tench, once called the doctor fish, as his slime was said to heal the wounds of fish that touched it. A girl in a white dress was being courted out among the cars, as her voice swarmed and puddled into laughter. I felt like some old pike, all badged with sores, wanting to swim in touch with soft mouthed life. So when I think of that poem, the first thing that strikes me about that poem is that it's very, very moist. A lot of its imagery has got to do with wetness and moistness and slime. And this is characteristic of soul. Soul tends to be moist. It tends to be sort of damp. Where spirit, by contrast, tends to be hot. It's associated, you could say that soul is kind of associated elementally with earth and water. Whereas spirit is elementally associated with fire and air. You could say one has a tendency to descend, to go downward, and the other has a tendency to ascend, to go upward. Yeah? Just as those elements, yeah? As water will always sort of find the lowest point. And also we've got in this poem, we've got the image of the wound in a way, wounded fish. Fish in a way, for me anyway, are symbols of soul. Where birds, for instance, tend to be more symbols of spirit. So we've got this sense of the wound, we've got this sense of longing, there's a lot of longing. You've got this image of a pike, which is the most predatory of all freshwater fish. I don't know if anybody looked in a pike's mouth. It has rows and rows of very, very sharp teeth, very pointed teeth, yeah. And then you've got this old pike, all badged with sores, wanting to swim in touch with soft mouth life. Well, actually, the mouth pike is very hard and dangerous. So you've got this great sense of longing. I think this is another characteristic of soul, is this kind of longing, soul kind of longing in a way. Anyway, there's a poem, I hope, you know, it gives you a bit more of a sense of soul, perhaps, that kind of thing. To my mind, it's a very sort of soul. Okay, so I'm just going to say a little bit. See if I can say a little bit about this idea of soul making, what I mean, and what one might mean by this sort of idea of soul making, and how well, I don't know that we do it, but how we can sort of allow it to come about in a way it does itself in a certain sense. So, I mean, this poem by Heaney, really, that poem by Heaney is quite a good example in my mind. Of soul making, and I think actually all poetry in itself is an example of soul making. Yeah. So what a poet, one way you can see what a poet is doing is turning towards his own experience. Okay. turning towards his own experience, something comes out of that. So there's a distinction that I find very useful. This is another distinction that comes from Hillman. He makes this distinction between what he calls event and experience. And he's using event, Hillman does this a lot, unfortunately, or fortunately, I don't know. He's using event in the sense of most of us would probably use the word experience. So event for him is just about everything that happens to you. Yeah. So you go through life having all these events. And he says, rarely, and I think probably, arguably, increasingly rarely, in his way of thinking, do events become experience. So events, experience comes out of turning towards and being with events. So this is the process of soul making. The process of soul making is this process of being able to come into relationship with what happens to us in a particular way. So I think for most of us, I think we could say more and more, culturally speaking, we're interested in events. So, you know, we're interested in going to sort of exotic places on holiday. We're interested in sort of, some of us, not me, but some of us are interested in sort of extreme sports. You know, we're interested in movies, we have all this kind of input. And usually, not always, but usually, very often, we just go from one event to another. And we can't get enough of them. You know, we can't get enough of them. And we sort of more and more, at least in the West, take this way of living, take this way of being in the world as normal. But of course it's not normal. Not if you look at human history. Most human beings in the past were born in some little hamlet somewhere, some little village. And they spent their whole life there. They never went anywhere. They never saw action movies. They never did extreme sports. They never went to exotic. And I'm not saying that's a good thing, but I'm saying it's very different, and it's a very different way. Has a very different effect on the psyche. So the problem with going from one thing to another is that we never actually spend time with these events. So I'd suggest that one of the things that meditation offers us is the opportunity to spend time with what's happened to us. Yeah? Just to be with the events of our life. Just to sit with the events of our life. And this Hillman calls, this is roughly, I think, what Hillman would call soul making. And it's roughly what I've sometimes meant by using the term to turn towards our experience. So in meditation, we're primarily interested, at least from a soul perspective, we're primarily interested in just being with our experience, coming into a kind of intimate relationship with our experience, you know, being intimate with our relationship, with our experience. This is another poem, and it's another poem because I think it's a fantastic example. To some extent, all good poetry is this. All good poetry is trying to turn event into experience. It's trying to turn it into... And the thing about experience in this sense is that it's ultra-individual, if you like. It's got a... When we come into something with depth, it becomes more than individual. So this is what happens when a poet works on something that's happened. You know, a lot of poetry is about very simple things. But because they dwell with it, because they kind of sit with it, it becomes something that has a resonance has a kind of universal resonance, at least a wider resonance. So anyway, this is late. This is Christopher Reed, and this is late. And I'll say a little bit about this maybe afterwards, but it's fairly self-evident. Late home one night, I found that she was not yet home herself. So I went to bed and waited under my blanket mound till I heard her come in and hurry upstairs. My back was to the door, and without turning round, I greeted her. My voice made only a hollow, parched-throated ka, 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 which I was unable to translate into words, and anyway lacked the force to carry. Nonplussed but not distraught, I listened to her undress and sidle round to the far side of our bed and lift the covers. Of course I'd forgotten she'd die. I arranged my arm for our normal cuddling caress and felt the bed mattress welcome her as she settled and rolled towards me. But as I went to catch her, it was already too late, and she had whisked clean away. That's from a recent collection of Christopher Reed's, which are all the whole books about grief and loss. And in particular, it's about the loss of his wife. And I think it's a fantastic example. What I've been calling soul making. It's a fantastic example, because the thing about it is that if you take that poem, or if you take the collection as a whole, and you see it in that poem, it tells us something about turning towards. It tells us that turning towards isn't about understanding. It's not about trying to understand. It's about experiencing things more and more deeply. This gives us a very important clue to the whole essence of our practice. Because most of the time we instinctively turn away from what's painful or difficult. And you could say the fundamental insight of the Buddha was that turning away causes us more suffering in the long run. That tendency to turn away, even through Buddhism and turning away, just turning away in Buddhism is called grasping or aversion. This is one of the ways. A big way we turn away is by coming up into the head, by thinking, by rationalizing. This is spirit. The spirit wants to understand things. It wants to understand things because it wants to deal with them. It wants to deal with them, put them behind it, and get on with life. And of course, there's something to be said But when we do that, or if that's all we do, we increasingly leave parts of ourselves behind. We're increasingly kind of numb parts of ourselves. So you get in this poem, Christopher Reeve, sitting with, writing about, experiencing more deeply, until his grief becomes something which can be communicated, shared, and connected. I was saying this down in the shrine room, you know, that our basic choice with suffering is not whether we have it or not. We're going to have it whether we like it or not. Our basic choice is what we do with it. And I suppose I'm suggesting that if you're a poet, part of what you do with it is you write poetry about it, and this is soul making. If you're a meditator, part of what you try and do with it is sit with it. You try and sit with it, you try and turn towards it. You try and bring a sense of awareness and tenderness to it. You don't try and get rid of it. There's this fantastic little poem, it's a very short one though. When sometimes when you read a poem, they just say something to you, you know, just strike you in a particular way. And this was the case with this one. The first reading, I just thought, Christ, fantastic. You know, and this is Gilbert Sorrentino. He says, this is interesting enough, I find it's called Anatomy. The poem's called Anatomy. Goes, portions of the heart die, are dead, they are dead, cannot be exorcised or brought back to life, they're dead. Do not disturb yourself to become whole. Go down into the darkness and sit with them. Once in a while. So when I came across that poem, it was a kind of relief. So it's a sense of relief, because I think very often in our practice we're kind of driven. We take up spiritual practice, we take up spiritual practice because we want to mend ourselves. We've kind of fallen into this trap of what Hillman is trying to release the psyche from, you know, this conceit that we have these days of thinking that everything should be able to be healed, should be able to be integrated, should be able to be dealt with. And what this leaves us is very isolated, I think, very hard and isolated or numb very often, and very disappointed. It's not going to happen. But this poem to me is a very interesting poem because he says, they're dead but cannot be exorcised. They can't be got rid of. There's no religious rite by which you can get rid of them. They can't be brought back to life. It's a very interesting image for me. They're just sort of there. Portions of the heart, they've died, but they've got there. And of course, strong relationship in my mind between Christopher Reeve's poem and this poem, because this is the exact really the experience of losing someone that we love. When we lose someone that we love, they're dead, they're no longer there. But of course, they are still there. They can't be got rid of. They can't be exercised from our psyche, even if we'd like to do that. But they can't be brought back to life. And what we can do is sometimes, in the poem, go down into the darkness and sit with them once in a while. That's what we can do. I was reminded, when I was thinking of this, I was reminded, I mean, it has a lot of resonance to me about this whole idea of ancestors. This is something, again, that I think our culture's lost more and more. We're losing this sense of ancestors, which plays such a vital part in so many cultures. You know, they have this sense of ancestors. They're kind of there. They're dead, but they're there. They're still somehow active in the world. Just as the dead are somehow often very active in our psyche, you know, they're still active, but they're dead. There's this, years ago, I saw this wonderful film about Madagascar. Traditionally in Madagascar, they bury the dead above the ground. They have these tombs above the ground. And one day a year, they open up these tombs, and they take the dead out. These dead are wrapped in cloth, and they take them out as a tribute to the dead, and they dance around them. So if it's a recently deceased person, they're dancing around with this decaying corpse. If it's someone that's been dead for a long time, they're just dancing. They're dancing around with this bag of bones. And they do this as a sort of treat for the dead, you know, once a year. You know, I shouldn't laugh at them. Once a year they get them out and they have a good dance. You know, it's wonderful. That's wonderful. Anyway, so again, there's a sense that these things are still active. And I think so much of... Again, this is a sort of Hillman, this would be a sort of Hillman with my criticism as well, as a modern psychology or some versions of this. They want to sort of cure everything, you know. They want to lay the dead to rest, as it were, but this isn't quite how it is, really. This isn't quite how it is, you know. And this sort of tendency, this is the kind of the ego, the spirit, wants it, because they interfere with your life, they interfere with getting on, they kind of hold you back, like, you know, you don't want to waste your time on that, you just want to get on with your life, you know. So this is a sort of heroic in a sense, it's not really, you know, the dead is dead, let's get on with life, you know. And this is another thing we could say about soul as contrast to spirit in the way Hillman uses the term at least, is that soul has a very strong affinity with death. Has a very strong affinity with death. But spirit doesn't really have a very strong sense. It's not really interested. I was saying that spirit, in a way, is identified with the heroic. And I think it's very interesting that very few heroes grow old. Heroes tend to die young. Archetypally speaking, and I think this is because as an archetype, it cannot sustain us as we age. It's not a sustaining archetype, you know, the heroic, this sort of thrusting and wanting to go on. It's kind of appropriate, perhaps, when we're young, but it's not really a sustaining archetype. It doesn't really hold us as we age, as we ourselves start to face decay. And it's interesting, you don't really get old heroes. You know. When I was thinking about that, what came to mind was Don Quixote, of course, who's a fantastic example of a hero archetype. Where it's gone askew, of course he isn't a hero. And of course, actually, he's a very soulful figure, but he's very deluded. He doesn't realise that he's a soulful. He thinks he's still a hero, and of course it's slightly pathetic. It's very poignant. You know, very poignant when that happens. Anyway, I'm on dinner with time. Oh God, I've only just started. I'm afraid. Oh God, I did want to talk about this one. I'm a complete. My drug of choice these days is the radio, among other things. And I sometimes listen to the BBC World Service. In the middle of the night, and they have these wonderful programs on there that you never hear on daytime radio. And they had this fantastic program last week, and it wasn't fantastic. I mean, it was terrible, but it was very, very moving. And it was about the number of children killed on the roads in the world. I can't remember the number, it was millions. It was this huge fatality of children killed every year on the road. Not so much in developed countries. And they focused on this I'm very sorry, I can't even remember what country it was, but they focused on a country in Africa. And they had this interview with what we'd call a lollipop man, a crossing guard, yeah? To someone else.
Yeah, it was great. Wasn't
it was fantastic.
Stepping in front of us.
Yeah, it was fantastically moving. And so his job was to get these children over this great highway that had all these trucks thundering through it. And there was no crossing. You just had to go out there and, you know, had to wait for a kind of gap in the traffic and get these kids across in hope that the trucks kind of slowed down a bit. And it was really dangerous. And he was speaking about this job, and it was just so moving to hear.
He was saying, my children.
Yeah, my children. And he obviously had this real love for these children. And he obviously had a real sense of pride, in the most positive use of that term, a real sense of pride in this work, in this job, and saw it as something really worthwhile. And it just struck me, it is exactly what Hillman would call a calling. I don't know why I found this so effective. It was effective. It was something because this guy in Africa, he's probably getting paid virtually nothing for doing this job. You know? He's risking his life. And he's got this wonderful love and sense of meaning. He obviously had this real sense of what he did was meaningful. He's just a lollipop man. I thought it's so different for most Westerners, you know. Most of us wouldn't do a job like that. You know? And of course, if you start to think about it, it has all this sort of archetypal, obviously he wouldn't use this term, but it had all this sort of archetypal resonance, you know. Sort of fairy, I thought of Virgil, you know, taking fruit people. Through hell, it was like he was ferrying these children through this sort of little portion of hell and getting them to the other side. A very strong thing. And I mention this because this is another example. This is kind of, he had a sense of soul, you see, this guy. He had a sense of soul because he could see the importance and the love and the meaning of what he was doing. And I think this is why we're interested in this idea of soul, because what soul is trying to do is trying to connect us down into the meaning of events, in the meaning of our actions, in the meaning of our life. But this meaning is quite different from understanding. It's a more like a flavour or a taste or a tone in the way that we see life, in the way that we be in life. Yeah. And I think for me, this is really at the heart. This is really the heart of meditative practice. This is what we're trying. We're not even trying to do it, but this is kind of why one might meditate. To allow oneself to start to relax into or sink into or descend into this kind of meaningful ground of our being, you know. Yeah. There's quite a lot more I was going to say, but I won't. I'll just try and make it a bit more relevant in a way. So, I think from the point of view of meditating, we can say we need both sort of elements. We need a bit of spirit in meditation. I'm not sort of rubbishing that or saying we don't need that. We need some spirit. We need some fire in this sense. We need some sense. And we also need this sort of soul, which is this more moist, meandering ability to just be with things as they are. This ability to sit with things, to turn towards things. Suzuki Roshi, the Zen teacher, he talks about pulling out the weeds and planting them at the root of the plant, putting them at the root of the plant, or composting. So it's again this idea that we need to sort of let things kind of compost, break down, to turn event into experience. We need this time. Sitting with. So we need this, and kind of slightly paradoxically perhaps, I'd suggest that slightly paradoxically we find spirit in body. I say quite slightly paradoxical because, as I said before, in a way soul is very much associated with body. Spirit tends to be more associated with mind, but from a meditative point of view, from a practical point of view, what I'd suggest is that we try and find the spirit in our practice, in the posture of our practice. So when we sit, we try and sit with spirit. This means we try and sit with a sense of dignity, a sense of energy, a sense of uprightness, a sense of purpose, and that's in the posture. In the posture, we find it in the body, and as I say, and we look, you know, the attitude, in the mental attitude, we try and find spirit. We try and find soul. We try and allow there to be soul, which is a, really the essence of soul from a meditative point of view. We can't really make it happen. Spirit, our spirit, just like wants to say, okay, I need soul. How can I make this happen? But we can't really make it happen. This is to fall into spirit, to think that we might be made soul happen. But we can sit, we can try and encourage a mental attitude of kind of kindness, really. I think really it just comes down to something as simple as that. Our basic mental stance, if you like, is one just of kindness. As soon as we want something, in meditation, as soon as we want something, if we're in spirit, we'll be in the thrall of ideas like insight, enlightenment, pure awareness, these sort of ideas, the ideas of the spirit. Yeah. Hillman has this very nice quote where he says something like, the spiritual point of view always posits itself as superior and operates best within a fantasy of transcendence among absolutes and ultimates. That's right. So if you find yourself, there's a bit much taken in one bite, isn't it? But if you know, when we find ourselves wanting something, we're usually in the thrall, we're in the grasp of spirit in this sense. And as far as possible, mentally, we don't want to go there. We can find it in our body. Find it in our posture, in the dignity and strength of our posture. That can be the spirit. And in our mental attitude, that's where we're looking for the soul, which is, as I say, this kind of softness, this kind of openness, this kind of willingness to be with. Okay, I'll leave it there. But as I say, I'll try and get it wasn't completely different, but it was quite different from, I knew I would be able to read it if I read. But anyway, I will try and get the text, because that actually, I think the text is some reason I did want to end with one last poem. I missed that one. I've dropped a couple. Anyway, I did want to end up with a Ryokin poem. Simply because I don't know, Ryokin, he's this old monk, you know, he's this, well, he wasn't old all the time, but I think of him as an old monk. He's someone that, I don't know, probably about the last 40 years of his life, he lived a very, very simple life. 17th century, is that right? I think it's 17th century. He lived in a very small little hermitage. I think it was like one, you know, very small anyway. Begged for his food. He was renowned for enjoying the company of children who play when in summer. He was snowed in a lot of the year in the winter. He was very snowy some parts of Japan, Japanese. In the spring he had come down and used to just spend his time sort of playing with local kids. It said that he was never refused a game of Go. Go is a Chinese, Japanese board game. It's very fun. And he liked a bit of sake and he did a bit of meditation and he wrote poems. This is what he did. And the fantastic poems. And when he was 70, I think it was 70, already quite frail, he only had a few years to live, he fell deeply in love with a nun of a 28, Titian, I don't know how you pronounce the name, Titian. And interestingly enough, it was a mutual thing, they were evidently inseparable for the last years of his life, wrote some beautiful love poetry, Jane. And it was her, actually, I mean, he's... some of you would know Ryokin, but he's regarded as a national treasure in Japan. He kind of encapsulates this particular sort of soulful quality of Japanese culture, and hugely beloved. And it was this nun who, after his death, was largely responsible for collecting and getting his poems published. He wasn't interested now in his life, you know. It didn't occur to him, he was a beautiful calligrapher as well. Anyway, so I end with one of his. It's a very soulful poem. So when I think of this, I think of this old man in this, when this poem. He's an old man who wrote this poem. Staff in hand, I walk through the gate. Wisteria and ivy grow together along the winding mountain path. Birds sing quietly in their nest, and a monkey howls nearby. The old pines are full of poems. Reaching a high peak, village appears in the distance. I bend down for a drink of pure spring water. There is a gentle breeze and a full moon hangs overhead. By a deserted building, I pretend to be a crane, softly floating among the clouds. Okay, we'll leave that. Thanks for coming out on this wintry day.
Thank you.